In a trial, you have the facts and you have the law, but these elements have to be woven together. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and today on Odyssey, we'll talk about stories in the courtroom, the way lawyers use narratives to make the raw facts mean something, the way stories shape legal decision-making, and the way the legal process tries sometimes to keep stories from being spun. That's today on Odyssey, next after the news, here on WBEZ, Chicago. And welcome to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. When a witness takes the stand in a courtroom, he or she promises to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That seems like a pretty comprehensive oath, but also a practical impossibility. A witness probably won't even be asked for the whole truth, and the whole truth could go on forever. Instead, what a lawyer is after is a set of facts that can then be used to tell a story about what happened. Why does the storytelling process go on? What kinds of stories do lawyers tell? Are they always true? And is this storytelling a good thing? We're going to talk about that today on the program. And joining us here in the studio are Steve Lubet, who is professor of law at Northwestern University and the author of Nothing But the Truth, Why Trial Lawyers Don't, Can't, and Shouldn't Have to Tell the Truth. Jim Ferguson, a partner at Sun and Shine Nath, and why lawyers shouldn't have to tell the whole truth. I want to stick that in there. Because we're not talking about lying here. We're also joined by Jim Ferguson, a partner at Sun and Shine Nath and Rosenthal, and a former federal prosecutor. And joining us by phone is Peter Brooks, who is professor in the humanities at Yale University and the author of Troubling Confessions, Speaking Guilt in Law and Literature. Good morning to all of you, and thank you for joining me.
Good morning.
My apologies, Steve Lubet, for attributing a slander against lawyers to you. First of all, Jim Ferguson, let me start with you. Is this idea of getting some facts and spinning them together in a story, is that a reasonably accurate description of how a lawyer approaches a case?
Reasonably accurate. I have to qualify because it's important to bear in mind that what is the primary goal is to persuade the decision maker to accept your side of the case. In other words, to persuade the decision maker that you should win. And in the case of a jury trial, that means persuading 12 citizens from all walks of life that your version of the facts is the correct one. And in order to do that, you have to maintain your credibility, which means that you can't make statements or claims that aren't supported by the evidence in the case. So to the extent that you can present a coherent theory of the case, in other words, a story that is consistent with the facts, you're better able to persuade the jurors that you should win.
Steve Lubet, why the subtitle of your book, Why Trial Lawyers Don't, Can't, and Shouldn't Have to Tell the Whole Truth? You're talking about that lawyers select from among the facts, highlighting facts that make their theory work better, low-lighting facts that don't, but that this process is important to making sense of what's going on.
It's important to making sense of what's going on, and it's also really essential to finding out the important truth. Lawyers don't tell the whole truth because they want to succeed. They want to present the case in a way that's helpful to the client. As you pointed out, they can't tell the whole truth because it's physically important. And they shouldn't have to tell the whole truth because actually there's lots and lots of clutter in the real world that would be misleading or destructive of finding the sort of just truth, the core of justice in any case.
But, okay, in correcting my mistake earlier in saying that lawyers don't have to tell the truth, you point out very specifically in your book that, and as Jim Ferguson just pointed out, you have to base your story on the facts at hand. You can't just add things. You can't deny facts are in front of a jury. I mean, you can suggest that they're not true.
Well, ethical lawyers don't do that. Any skill is subject to abuse, weightlifting, marksmanship, poetry. People could use them all to evil purpose. But good lawyers, ethical lawyers, decent lawyers are absolutely committed to nothing but the truth. But within that, there's a lot of choices and decisions that can be made about what to bring forward and what to try to leave lying in the underbrush.
Well, go ahead, Peter Brooks.
Could I make a remark on that? It seems to me that, first of all, facts are not simply out there waiting to be made into stories. The stories that we choose to tell select, combine, and give meaning to the facts. In other words, we don't simply assemble facts into narratives. Our sense of how life can be made meaningful presides at our choice of facts and the way they're presented.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, what I'm really saying is that our sense of reality is constructed as a narrative. And once we decide what kind of story we want to tell about the facts, that actually alters and shapes the facts and the way they go together. So I think it's a mutual process. It's not just taking facts, dropping them into some sort of story compartment, but using our sense of a plausible story in selecting and shaping and combining the facts.
So turning a fact into, into evidence, into something that supports your story or your case or, in a coherent way, something that could be read in a number of ways.
Exactly. And it's not just a notion that the facts are out there, let's find the best story that fits them. You start with hypotheses, hypothetical stories about the way things usually happen, and that shapes your view of the facts and what are the relevant facts, and in fact, what are the facts.
That's a cornerstone of what psychologists call cognition theory, which comes as an insight to courts, but of course it's got a great history in the humanities and social sciences. The myth has always been that judges and jurors will listen to fact one and evaluate it, and then add fact two and evaluate that. This sort of building block approach, taking every datum or item of evidence individually. But the real story is exactly as Peter describes it, which is that people take information and fit it into frameworks, or psychologists call them scripts, which are pre-existing notions of how the world works, and interpret the information that way. And the challenge for a trial lawyer is, as Jim explains, is to locate the framework that people already have, and then select the facts available to them that will fit the client's story into one of those frameworks in a way that will result in the desired verdict.
Jim Ferguson, can you talk a bit about this process? Because it seems like we're not just talking about plot. You know, we're not just talking about this is what happened and this is who was where and this happened. But, you know, there's also some character and theme and things like that in order to make your story or your client's story more sympathetic, to make to make people lean in a particular direction. How do you go about, if you could describe the process of thinking about what your story is going to be?
You're exactly right that a lot of thought has to go into it. And the first step is to have a complete understanding of all the facts in the case, including the facts that are not helpful to your side. You have to identify the facts that are helpful to your side. You have to identify the facts that are more helpful to your opponent's side. You have to identify what issues, that is, factual issues, are not disputed by the parties and what issues are disputed by the parties. It's important to bear in mind that this is an adversary process, so that if there are facts that are not particularly helpful to your side, you can rest assured that if you don't bring them out, your opponent is going to bring them out. So part of the skill is not only identifying the facts that are helpful, but also coming up with a way to deal with facts that may not be so helpful to your side. Once you have an understanding of the universe of facts, and for the most part, both sides, at least in civil cases, have a pretty good understanding of what the universe of the facts are, you then have to construct a theory of the case. In other words, how can you present these facts in a way that will persuade the decision maker, in this case a jury, that your side should win? And once you have a theory of the case, which typically, but not always, is a story. Once you have a theory of the case, you then have to devise the most effective way to present the facts that support your theory of the case so that the jurors will accept your version of the facts as the correct one. This sometimes consist of themes. You may identify two or three themes that you think are critical to the success of your case. You then identify ways in which you can develop those themes through the testimony of your own witnesses, through the cross-examination of other witnesses, through documents, and through arguments. Or it may consist of an elaborate storyline which you can develop from opening statement, in your opening statement, and then continue throughout the trial.
Like, what sorts of themes? What sorts of themes would you be interested in using, or do you think might be persuasive?
It always depends on the facts of the case. It's almost too fact-specific to make generalizations about. But if you identify two or three facts that are particularly important to the acceptance of your theory, you then can come up with ways in which you can develop those facts through the testimony of witnesses. For example, and this also depends on what issues are disputed by the parties. If the case involves, for example, an allegation of bribery, there may be a dispute as to whether the businessman ever paid money to the senator. That may be a disputed fact. On the other hand, the parties may not dispute the fact that the businessman paid money to the senator, and what's disputed is the purpose of the payment. In that case, the defense would try to develop the theme that the businessman, for example, owed money to the senator, or to construct some sort of alternative explanation for the payment of the money. The prosecution, on the other hand, would try to develop a theme that the purpose of the payment was to bribe the senator to, for example, support a bill that was favorable to the businessman.
Let me give you an example. Say in the Clinton impeachment trial, which everybody has a pretty good recollection of, the theme, or a theme of the prosecution, was no one is above the law. Now, that there are no facts in there, right? That's not a story. It doesn't explain what happened. It's a moral appeal, right? No one is above the law. It tries to speak to the conscience of the community, and they use that as a reason that the president should be removed from office. And then on the defense side, the sort of counter theme was, well, it's only about sex. And, of course, that doesn't tell you any operative facts about it either, since it wasn't about sex at all. It was about perjury. But by repeating over and over, it's only about sex, you try to recast the sort of moral climate of the case in a way that was more favorable to the defense.
Peter Brooks, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that the Clinton case shows that, in a sense, one starts with theory, that each side in a case doesn't necessarily only start from the facts, but starts with a theory about how this should be interpreted. So I think that fact and theory are working together from the beginning of the case.
Well, now, is this process, are these stories, you know, each side has its story that it tells. Let me ask the either cynical or naive question. Is either one of these stories true? Is this process about trying to find out what actually happened and what is the real life sequence of events that generated these facts?
Well, I would go back to the word that Jim used earlier. It's about persuasion. What story is the more forceful, the more powerful, and will be accepted by the trier of fact as such?
Well, that's what the lawyers do. The lawyer's charge, or the lawyer's job, is to take true facts and make them persuasive. So in that sense, both stories are true. They're only composed of bits and pieces of things that actually happened.
Both stories are possible truths. They're both true renderings of what happened.
Well, that's right. Sometimes, you know, more times than you think, you don't really know what happened. Even the people who were there don't know what happened. Obviously not in every situation, but sometimes trials turn on intention and motive and belief, and that is so overlaid with post facto rationalization that even the people who were there don't know, and the best you can do is reconstruct it.
I think it's easier to talk about true stories and false stories in criminal cases, because in criminal cases it's more typically a black and white situation. And even in criminal cases, however, in which the truth may be that the businessman did indeed bribe the senator, the defense may be simply that the prosecution has not proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt. That may be the theme of the defense, that there are too many uncertainties, too many doubts, and in that sense, the defense story could be true. On the other hand, if the defense presented an elaborate theory which had the businessman paying the senator to repay a loan, for example, whereas the truth was it was a bribe, then that would be an example of a story that was presented to the jury that wasn't true. In civil cases, it's often more difficult to draw these black and white lines between truth. There are typically shades of gray, and you're talking about, as Peter mentioned, interpretations of facts. And in that sense, it really is more an exercise in marshaling the facts in the most persuasive way possible.
Could I point out that in terms of criminal procedure, some other countries, European countries on the whole, which follow an inquisitorial rather than adversarial procedure, do think that they're getting at the truth with some capital T, whereas our adversarial procedure really pits competing stories one against another and then tries to decide which is the more persuasive one.
Peter Brooks, there's also a sense in which the legal process, the legal system is about suppressing stories or takes a looks askance at stories.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of the rules of courtroom procedure are designed to break the narrative flow in the presentation of the evidence. They work by question and answer. Attorneys are not allowed to ask leading questions. There's some claim to get a kind of analytic distance from stories. And when you move up to appellate courts, it's always surprised me that stories are often disposed of very briefly. The courts are all about principle and rule. That includes the Supreme Court. And I think there is, on the part of the law in general, some suspicion or even some repression of the extent to which it is dominated by storytelling, by narrative.
Well, but you could also make the case that you could also argue that the what the law does is decide who's going to be the storyteller, that the advocates get to tell the stories, not the witnesses. And so there's control over who gets to structure a story.
Absolutely.
Well, but that's a winnowing function in order to make the stories comprehensible. If you left it up to the witnesses who don't understand necessarily the legal relevance of certain facts, the stories would be less purposeful, less coherent, and in a meta sense, they'd be less true. What I often say is that when you bring a good lawyer into the case, the story becomes truer than true because you leave out all of the distractions. You remove all of the distractions.
Jim Ferguson?
There's also a sense in which the American legal system in particular quite deliberately excludes evidence that could contribute to the truth-seeking process. Generally speaking, all the rules of evidence and the rules of courtroom procedure are designed to further the discovery of truth. But there's some very important exceptions to that. For example, in the criminal system, we have what's known as the exclusionary rule, in which evidence of unquestioned probative value, relevance, is nonetheless not put before the jury because a court has held that it was illegally obtained. We have, in addition, in the American system, the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, under which the defendant is not required to take the stand and give his or her version of events, and the jury is instructed that it cannot draw any adverse inference from that failure to take the stand. By contrast, under the continental system, the inquisitorial system, the defendant is expected to give his or her version of events under oath, and that obviously, in most cases, contributes to the discovery of truth. So there are important ways in which the American legal system, quite deliberately, in the name of higher values, or other values at least, excludes relevant evidence and therefore doesn't adopt truth-seeking as the highest goal.
Let me ask what each of you thinks is the response, and I don't know to what extent this is knowable or guesswork, but how do juries receive these stories? Do they buy one side or the other? Do they listen and piece together their own story in order to come to a conclusion? How is the story received? Jim Ferguson?
Let me go back to something I said earlier, and that is the key to winning the jury trial is maintaining credibility before the jurors. And that means that whatever theory of the case you present to the jurors must be solidly based on the evidence that the jurors are going to hear. If you overstate the case, if you make claims that aren't supported by the evidence that's introduced at trial, then you lose credibility with the jurors, and therefore you increase the likelihood that you're not going to prevail. So what I'm saying is that in order to succeed, you have to present a theory of the case that is based on evidence and will be perceived by the jurors as based on evidence. They don't always perceive it so.
Steve Lubet?
Cognition theory would tell you that jurors are inclined to accept one story or the other, that the story that's the most familiar, that makes the most sense, that is the most grounded in facts they accept as true, is the one that will succeed. Now, you know, people are infinitely interesting, and some will be very predictable by cognition theory, and some will be completely unpredictable, and some jurors will say, I believe part of this story and part of the other. But the sort of general phenomenon of persuasion is that decision makers will accept one version or the other. The challenge for the lawyer is to predict which version is going to be most likely to be accepted, and then to ferret out and discern the facts that will support that case in a way that's favorable to the client.
Peter Brooks, I'd like your thoughts on that, but also in general, what does that mean about the sorts of stories that are being told? I mean, we tell plenty of stories that you don't have to think are true, or you know flat out aren't true, and that can be enjoyable and entertaining. It seems to me that we're talking about a subset of stories, of possible stories.
Yes, well, on the question of jury psychology, it's an area where a lot of research is being done at the moment. And, of course, in expensive trials, the two sides can spend a great deal of money on jury consultants and so on. And you start with the selection of the jury and the attempt to keep off the jury people you think will be favorable to the other side. So I think that we need to know a lot more than we do about how juries decide cases. And I think the whole question of how they construct stories about real life, including their own lives, is very relevant to this. And I'd like to put in a pitch for the legal profession to spend more time studying what we call in literary criticism now narratology. That is how you construct stories and how stories are used as part of our cognitive toolkit to construct the world.
Steve Lubet?
No, that's great.
You're nodding in agreement.
No, I've been nodding in agreement and looking for the grant. I think that would be terrific. You know, let me give you a real well-known example of a way that leaving out a fact would have made the story truer. In the very famous O.J. Simpson case, a lot of people thought that the sort of the turning point in the trial was when the prosecutor asked Simpson to try on the glove.
Right.
And they're without any preparation, and he's got the rubber glove on underneath, and he goes to try on the bloody glove, and of course it doesn't fit, or it seems not to fit, and OJ tugs on it and says, too small. Right. Well, you know, that occurrence was completely true, right? Everything, we saw it right there in the courtroom, but it was tremendously misleading. If the prosecutor had left that factum out of the case, It would have been more accurate, I think, not less accurate. And I think the prosecutors would agree they should have just left that out. Their story would have been both more persuasive and truer without it.
Let me, follow up on a couple of things. We talked so far about the content of the story and, from my perspective at least, the importance of the theory of the case being solidly based on the evidence presented at trial. Also important, not as important perhaps, but also important is the way in which the story is presented. And that introduces the role of the lawyer. The lawyer is very much an actor on a stage when he or she is presenting a case before the jury. If the jury perceives, for example, that the lawyer is disorganized or does not appear to have confidence in the case, that's a fact that will influence the juror's perception of the merits of the case. Also, if the evidence is presented in a logical and well-organized and effective way, that's also going to influence the juror's perception of the case for reasons that are independent of the merits. If the effective use of exhibits, the effective use of charts or graphs to dramatically make important points are all part of the choreography of a trial that can influence the outcome, which is independent of the merits of the evidence. Peter referred to jury consultants, which are increasingly used, and they're used for two purposes, not simply to identify potential jurors that may or may not be receptive to your theory of the case, but also in mock trial exercises with surrogate jurors to sound out themes that you want to develop and present and get an initial trial run to see what works and what doesn't work with a potential audience. Because what typically happens, or what often happens, is that in preparation for trial, you become so immersed in the facts of the case that you may not get an accurate read on what sorts of themes are going to fly well and what sorts of themes are not going to fly well. So the mock trial exercise with surrogate jurors becomes a useful way to sort of test out the stories and themes that you might want to present at trial.
Well, now, are you talking about something so much of our perceptions of what goes on in a courtroom come from, unfortunately, TV and movies, or fortunately, I don't know. But to what extent is this a performance, and to what extent is performance, is it heavy-handed or dramatic, and what difference does that make?
If you mean dramatic, if you're referring to dramatic flourishes by the lawyer, for example, I don't regard that as something that has any real influence on the outcome of the trial. What does have an influence on the outcome of the trial is preparation and presentation. The lawyer has to communicate that he or she has mastered the facts of the case, is devoted to the correctness of the outcome that is being urged on the jurors, and is effective in presenting that theory to the jury. So you need clarity, you need credibility, you need to convey confidence and preparation.
All right, let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and also take some phone calls at 312-832-3124, 312-832-3124. We're talking today about narratives and storytelling and the law, and we'll continue that conversation in just a moment. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.
This is WBEZ Chicago. This is a test of the emergency alert system. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system. This is WBEZ Chicago. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by Walsh Homeopathics, a natural pharmacy in Evanston offering herbal remedies and homeopathic advice for a variety of health concerns. Information at 847-864-1600 or at 2116 Central Street in Evanston. Support for this WBEZ program is provided by the Office of Secretary of State, which wishes to thank all listeners who are registered as organ donors. Lives are saved each year because of donors like 10-year-old Breanne Bacon of Lincoln, Illinois. The Organ Donors Program. Life goes on.
You're listening to Odyssey on WBEZ Chicago, 91.5 FM, Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and we're talking today about storytelling and the law. And we're joined by Steve Lubet, who is professor of law at Northwestern University and the author of Nothing But the Truth, Why Trial Lawyers Don't, Can't, and Shouldn't Have to Tell the Whole Truth. Steve Lubet will be speaking Saturday, April 28th at 3 p.m. at Great Expectations Bookstore in Evanston, if you want. Will you be, talking and signing books?
Talking, signing books, giving tours of a great independent bookstore.
The whole shebang, 3 o'clock Saturday the 28th. We're also joined by Jim Ferguson, who is a partner at Sun and Shine, Nath and Rosenthal, and a former federal prosecutor. And joining us by phone is Peter Brooks, professor in the humanities at Yale University and the author of Troubling Confessions, Speaking Guilt in Law and Literature. We'll take some phone calls in a few minutes at 312-832-3124, 312-832-3124. Now, let me ask this question. Jim Ferguson, I'll start with you. Is this process, is this a good process? Is it a good thing that this is the way we do it? Or is that an irrelevant question? I mean, this is the system we have, and obviously it has quite a bit of merit. But I mean, I could see someone listening to this program, or imagine someone listening to this program and thinking, well, you know, that's about spinning. That's about spin. And it's about, you know, not finding out what really happened, and that might be a problem.
I think someone could have that perspective only if you were focusing entirely on what the lawyers were doing and ignoring what is really the key aspect of the trial, and that is the presentation of evidence. The lawyers do not present evidence, and the judge is very clear in instructing the jury that what the lawyers say is not evidence. The trial consists, and this dominates the trial, the presentation of witness testimony, the evaluation of the credibility of witnesses, the evaluation of documents and other evidence by 12 fair-minded citizens. I think, generally speaking, the process works well. To the extent the outcome of the process as a means of discovering the truth has been assessed, my understanding is it's generally regarded as a pretty effective, if costly, way of discovering the truth. Obviously, there are some notable exceptions to the rule, but as a general matter, I think it works pretty well.
Steve Lubat?
Not only does it work very well, I would make the argument that it's an extremely moral enterprise, that conducting trials the way we do is highly ethical and highly moral. And the reason for that is that life as it occurs, you know, as events happen, tremendously disorganized, ambiguous, hard to understand, but legal decisions, when you bring something into court, are binary. You know, you have to have a winner and a loser. You have to have guilty or innocent. And it's the process of bringing coherent structure to that disorganized mass of events that allows a court to make any decisions at all. And since you have to have legal decisions in order to have justice or civilization, it's really quite essential. Now speaking to the alternative model, the European inquisitorial system, here's what I would just like to point out. We have wrongful convictions all the time. In Illinois, you have 12 people who had full adversary trials and were nonetheless wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death. Can you imagine how many wrongful convictions you would have if you didn't have an advocate for the accused, if you simply had a magistrate or a judge asking questions and pulling out information without somebody there to say, wait a minute, you haven't thought about it this way. Look at this other way of interpreting those facts. Look at the facts you left out. Look at the things you forgot. It is a tremendously necessary moral aspect of the judicial system.
Peter Brooks?
I would agree with everything that's been said. I do think it is a moral system. I think perhaps we're a little bit complacent about it at the moment, assuming that everything works just fine. I think that, you know, the work that's been done precisely at Northwestern on the Justice Project shows how many false convictions there are, and in a society that insists upon keeping the death penalty, that's a very serious business indeed.
But it seems to me, maybe this is a naive view, but when we're the system that we're describing, when it works in its correct form, you know, when you have lawyers who are competent and who do their job well and attentively and fulfill their professional responsibilities, that the cases of as we are well aware here in Chicago, you know, most of those cases of wrongful conviction involve some sort of, you know, serious dereliction of duty on somebody's part somewhere along the way. And, I mean, any system is going to have that problem.
Well, I think that's true. And one thing that's happened in American criminal justice, at least, is that an enormous amount of responsibility is devolved upon the police in questioning suspects, taking them into custody, and making sure that the police are well-informed, play by the rules, and so on, has become a big problem. We have, for instance, the Miranda warnings governing confessions by suspect. But Miranda is a rather weak tool considering what it has to do. And that's just one example, I think. I think we need further protections for the whole pre-trial process in criminal procedure.
All right, let's take a phone call, 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Cynthia. Good morning, Cynthia. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Good morning. I have a question, and unfortunately, I've missed a lot of your program, but I heard one of your experts say that in a trial, what lawyers say is not considered evidence, and I wondered if that applies in a divorce case before a judge with no jury.
Jim Ferguson?
Yes, the same rule would apply. The judge would well understand that the lawyer is simply making arguments based on whatever evidence is introduced during the proceeding, and I would not expect the judge to have any difficulty in separating the arguments of the lawyer from the evidence that was actually introduced during the proceeding.
But as a lawyer, would you present the case differently if you were presenting it to a judge rather than to a jury?
Yes. The answer is yes.
You'd make it shorter.
Right. The judge's tolerance for long-winded presentations is perhaps not as great as the juror's. But there are very important differences when the decision maker is the judge as opposed to jurors. For one fact, or for one thing, the judge is a single individual. It's an individual who is learned in the law and will presumably have had quite a bit of experience in applying legal principles to disputed facts. So much of the effort that would be otherwise go into persuading the fact finder through the use of sophisticated charts and exhibits, you could dispense with all that in dealing with a judge.
But do you still have to come up with a story? Do you still have to come up with a version of events?
You have to come up with a theory of the case, and you have to come up with a theory of the case that is based on the evidence that the judge is going to hear. If you don't have a plausible theory of the case that's based on the evidence, you're going to lose. So in that sense, the same rule applies.
No, you're making a big mistake if you try a case to a judge without thinking you need a story or a narrative that can be followed in that fashion. Judges are people, too. Cognition theory applies equally to judges as to jurors. And I think you will find that judges believe things exactly in the same way that people do, except, of course, the judges also understand the law.
All right, Cynthia, thanks for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Matt. Good morning, Matt. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hi. I wanted to ask the panelists about the exclusionary rule, which you talked about before. And it's, in my opinion, that's one of the biggest things that sort of contributes to the public's cynicism maybe about the judicial process. And it's certainly not the only way to punish over excessive law enforcement, and it leads to, in my opinion, a lot of things like judges being or juries being sequestered, where you get the impression that the jury is seeing something totally different from what someone who just came into the courtroom and watched the trial would see, and that seems to be destructive of the whole judicial system if people don't think that what goes on in the courtroom is what contributes to the decision.
Jim Ferguson, you want to comment?
This is from the perspective of a former federal prosecutor. The exclusionary rule, of course, comes into play in criminal cases, not civil cases. And it's been the subject of a lot of study. The extent to which it actually influences or has a significant influence on the outcome of criminal cases is, as I understand it, the subject of quite a bit of disagreement. And so... the real issue is the perception of the exclusionary rule and the perception that you just referred to, that it really is not consistent with the goal of discovering the truth. The judgment that's made in the case of the exclusionary rule is that that is an acceptable price to pay in order to create a deterrent for unacceptable behavior by law enforcement. And how you come out on that dispute, I think, is going to depend on whether or not you can come up with some other means that would achieve the same goal, number one, or whether you think the goal of truth in the courtroom is more important than the goal of deterring law enforcement from unacceptable behavior.
But it raises an interesting point, because in a well-publicized trial, the public at large might have access to a much wider array of information and larger number of facts than the jury will, because of various rules that determine what can be introduced as evidence, not just the exclusionary rule, but other ways in which evidence is structured. And, you know, the extent to which, in extreme cases, a jury is not allowed to get other information or discouraged from getting other information outside of the courtroom. So the sense, this gets back to, I guess, that question of whether, you know, the public might have some sense of, here's what happened. We think we know what happened, but nobody's going to tell the jury that version of the story.
Well, there isn't an exclusionary rule. There are actually three or four different exclusionary rules, and Peter is quite expert in one of them, so we should make sure that he says something about confessions before we leave this topic. But sometimes evidence is excluded because it's unreliable. That is, it might seem reliable. It might appear as though it's got great probative value, but experience in court demonstrates that actually it does not, and therefore it's excluded for that reason. And not much can be done about that. Eyewitness identification is a perfect example. Most people would tell you that there's no better evidence than eyewitness identification, but all of the studies tell you that it's quite unreliable, actually, and for that reason, now and then, eyewitness identifications are actually excluded from court because they're so misleading. But I'd be interested in hearing what Peter has to say about confessions.
Peter Brooks?
Well, I think the exclusionary rules in general are necessary to preserve the morality of the process that Steve was talking about earlier. The notion is that the evidence that has been obtained in ways that violate the law is tainted at the source, and therefore you can't tell that it truly is evidence. And that's certainly true in confessions. If someone has been coerced or persuaded to confess in ways that we think are wrong, it can very often be a false confession in the worst of cases. So I think that exclusionary rules don't necessarily mean that there are facts out there that are not getting to the jury, but that the facts have somehow themselves been made dubious by the way they were obtained.
Well, I think we have to separate out the exclusion of evidence on the grounds of unreliability, in which we can all agree with the principle, although we may disagree with its application in specific cases. And then the exclusion of evidence that is of unquestioned probative value on the grounds that some other higher value must be served. For example, evidence that's obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment that would clearly demonstrate that the defendant was guilty of the crime charged.
Possession of marijuana, for example.
Right. Yeah, it becomes much more difficult to justify that exclusion if your goal is the discovery of truth, because it frustrates the discovery of truth. And it becomes much more difficult to justify the exclusion if you feel that there are other ways in which the police could be deterred, for example, through discipline or through termination or through civil actions. And the real debate that's raging in those cases is whether or not there are more effective ways to achieve that goal. Similarly with confessions, there's no question that coerced confessions are unreliable. And for that reason, nobody, I think, really makes a serious argument that coerced confession should be admitted to trial. What becomes much more difficult, though, is to apply that rule to a general prohibition against calling the defendant as a witness in a judicial proceeding in which there's no threat of coercion, and arguing that that should not be that testimony should not be heard.
Right. There are other factors, I think, come into play, which have to do with how we want to treat criminal defendants and criminal suspects, large moral issues.
All right, let's take some more phone calls. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Phil. Good morning, Phil. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Just, I've got a question. I wanted to know why Louisiana is still using Napoleonic law and how that affects the process.
Who wants to take on that one? Steve Lubet, I'm looking at you.
Well, they still use Napoleonic law, the French Civil Code, as opposed to British common law as the basis of the law. But they're still subject to the Constitution, which overrides individual state procedures. So I think it doesn't actually affect criminal cases at all, particularly much in Louisiana.
All right, Phil, thanks for your call. 312-832-3124. Let's talk with Sean. Good morning, Sean. You're on Chicago Public Radio.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm an attorney in Chicago. I practice primarily criminal law. And I was wondering what the panel, particularly the professor from Northwestern, thinks of the fact that in Cook County, and particularly in Chicago, the vast majority of criminal cases proceed by way of bench trial. I've talked to a lot of attorneys at various conferences from around the country, and they're always shocked by the percentage of criminal cases in Chicago and Cook County that waive their right to a jury trial. I'm just wondering what the panel thinks about that, if it's a strange anomaly that they've seen anywhere else in the country.
I'm really not able to comment. I haven't seen any comparative statistics about it, so I just don't know.
Jim Ferguson, any thoughts?
I wasn't even familiar with that fact, so I'm afraid I don't have any thoughts on that.
Okay, Sean, sorry, we can't help you out. 312-832-3124. I do want to go back, though, to the question of jurors, because picking up Jim Ferguson on something that you said, it seems to me that this whole question of telling a story is, you know, it's connected directly to the fact that this jury is made up of people just like the defendant, you know, presumably peers, people who would interpret a story or react to a story in a similar way, in a way that perhaps a judge wouldn't, because a judge has dealt with sets of facts like these before and made decisions about them before. Could you each talk a little bit more about that? I mean, who we're telling the story to and what assumptions were underlie the idea of how someone's going to interpret it?
I think there are a couple of things that have to be taken into account in that regard, Gretchen. One thing is that the judge's experience in hearing cases similar to this and dealing with factual issues similar to the one that is currently before the judge will be regarded as a plus by one side and a minus by the other. Generally speaking, my guess is prosecutors would not be unhappy, for example, to have cases tried by courts, by the judge. The judge has had experience in dealing with criminal defendants. The judge has had experience in passing judgment on individuals. The judge has had experience in receiving stories that the judge rejected as implausible. On the other hand, from the defense side, in a criminal case, I think there would be an advantage to having jurors decide many defense cases because for precisely the opposite reason. They do not have experience in passing judgment on people. There may be some reluctance to pass judgment on individuals. They may be more receptive to the defense theory of the case than a judge would be. So those are important differences, and I think that they should be taken into account in deciding whether or not you want a judge or a jury to hear the case.
And you're also operating on a different set of presuppositions. I mean, for example, Steve Lubet, you raised the issue of eyewitness testimony. And to some extent, an attorney for whatever side can rely on the notion that a juror finds that reliable, even if, you know, whereas a judge would know that that isn't the most reliable testimony in the bunch,
yeah,
perhaps.
One hopes. The likelihood of doubt, which, of course, is what defendants want, the likelihood of doubt rises exponentially when you increase the number of decision makers. And so for that reason, defendants looking for doubt would almost always prefer a jury to a judge. Judges also understand the necessity of ruling, the fact that a trial is a binary event, very different from the sorts of decisions you make in real life where you can decide a little bit now and a little bit later and revisit the decision another time. You know, judges understand the need for ruling now, making it final, and getting to a decision, which also would change the way that you would pitch a case. But let me just return to stories. All that having been said, everyone is persuaded by the coherence and meaningfulness of the story, and that includes judges.
Peter Brooks, any thoughts?
I just want to interject here the strange American tradition, which I believe still exists, of jury nullification, that juries responding to the story and to the witnesses and to the defendants can essentially throw out the law and decide on the basis of their hunch as to where the truth lies. And that's That's quite an amazing fact about our system. It doesn't happen very often, but it still happens occasionally.
On the basis of a hunch or on the basis of a social judgment about
yes.
The morality of the outcome.
We just have a few minutes left, but Steve Lubet, I want to talk a bit about your book, Nothing But the Truth, Why Trial Lawyers Don't, Can't, and Shouldn't Have to Tell the Whole Truth. It's a bunch of stories.
It is a bunch of stories. It's seven stories of trials. Some of them are fictional and some of them are real. And it explains the way that lawyers either did or could have constructed the narrative that they wanted to tell.
And it does not include O.J.?
It does not include O.J. It does include Wyatt Earp.
For people who are avoiding O.J., and there are people out there, for the O.J. junkies, sorry, there's plenty of books for you. But for those avoiding O.J., nothing to fear here. But these are both contemporary and historical stories about creating a meaning from the set of facts.
Right. We begin with the trial of John Brown in 1859 following the raid at Harper's Ferry and go up through a contemporary American criminal trial, each time showing how some facts are used and some are left out and how the lawyers on either side structure their narratives.
Peter Brooks, let me ask you one final question. What would you like the legal profession to learn from narratology if they were to get these grants that Steve Lubet would like?
I think they could learn a good deal about how readers receive and understand stories, sometimes what we call a reader reception theory. We now think of stories as having not only narrators, but narratees, the putative audience to whom the story is told. And I think the law could learn something from studying what literary critics have done on that and expanding upon it, because obviously the law doesn't have the leisure to stay within theory and speculation. It has to make a decision. That's what makes it different from literary theory. But I think the two fields could learn a lot from one another.
Jim Ferguson, what are your thoughts on that?
I think there's much to be learned. I think what lawyers do in practice is a kind of rough approximation of this art, and so there's much to be gained by learning more about it.
All right, well, we'll wrap it up there. Jim Ferguson is a partner at Sun and Shine, Knapp and Rosenthal, and a former federal prosecutor. Steve Lubet is professor of law at Northwestern University and the author of Nothing But the Truth, Why Trial Lawyers Don't, Can't, and Shouldn't Have to Tell the Whole Truth. Steve Lubet will be at Great Expectations Bookstore, 911 Foster Street in Evanston on Saturday, April 28th. At 3 p.m. if you would like to hear more about the stories. Peter Brooks is professor in the humanities at Yale University and the author of Troubling Confessions, Speaking Guilt in Law and Literature. Thank you all very much for joining me this morning.
Very good being here.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Joshua Andrews for producing and directing. Thanks to Mike Gilmore and Harold Britton for engineering. Thanks to everyone who called, and apologies to those whose calls we couldn't get to. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk about human beings and what makes them different from animals and why this line keeps slipping around. Worldview with Jerome McDonnell is up next. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to WBEZ Chicago.